That's my turn. We were in the middle of a topic. We were discussing the issue, a very famous passage in the Rambam, an extended passage about the importance of free will, Bechira in Judaism. And I had mentioned that the Rambam discusses four distinct but interrelated questions. The first question, which is a relatively simple question, is how can human beings have free will if God is all-powerful? Doesn't free will mean that God's power is limited in some way? And on that, the Rambam's answer was, that is a self-imposed limitation that God himself put on himself. God could certainly override our free will. He generally chooses not to, so that our goodness is chosen and not compelled. And therefore, the Rambam says very simply, any self-imposed limitation on divinity is not a limitation on God's omnipotence. That's question number one. Question number two is, if God knows the future, how can I have a choice? That's going to God's knowledge. If God knows, God knew a million years ago, before there was anything, God knew that this morning I would daven or not daven, then how could it be said a million years later, I have a choice to daven or not to daven? The choice was already made. So if you recall, the Rambam's answer to that is a bit more complicated, but it basically says that that is a problem only if you look at things in a time-based past, present, future, because then you have an issue that that which already happens is that there's no choice. But if you look at God as seeing everything in the present moment, so to speak, then God seeing me daven a million years ago is not changing my choice. He's just looking at what it is I'm choosing to do. Okay, now then the Rambam asks a third question, which is textual. And the third question is, let us go back to the covenant of the parts. This is a very important part of the Torah. When God makes a covenant with Avraham Avinu, remember Avraham cuts up animals, and the divine presence goes between the animals. There's a covenant. And God says, Yadoa Teda, you shall know that your children shall be enslaved in a land that is not theirs, and they will be subjugated and afflicted for 400 years, although we're only at 210 years. God tells Avram, there will be a slavery and a persecution. This will happen. And then God says, and the nation that enslaves them, I will judge and punish. And then you will leave with great wealth. So the Rambam raises this question. God decreed there would be an enslavement. There would be a persecution. This was told to Avram. God says this is what is going to happen. So how could God then say in the same sentence, and I will punish the nation? Okay, be sure this is not the question of God hardening Paro's heart. Be sure you understand that. This is a different question. In fact, the Rambam's answer to this question doesn't answer that question. Okay, so be sure. Don't confuse the questions. This is a question. If God told Avram that there will be a slavery, that means there is no free will in this matter. They will be enslavers. Then how could God punish not just Paro, how could God punish the nation? Gam es hagoy asher yavodu. The nation that enslaves you, I will judge. You're punishing somebody for something they don't have free will over. And that's not just. That's not fair. Remember, the Rambam's argument is, you can't punish people for sinful actions that they do when they didn't have the free will to be righteous. So here, the Rambam answers the following. You'll notice that although God decreed that the Jewish people will be enslaved in a land that is not theirs, God did not decree which nation would do the enslaving. And even within that nation, God did not decree which individuals would do it. So yes, if the Egyptians would have been righteous people, and they wouldn't have enslaved the Jewish people, somebody else would have. Meaning, God did decree that the Jewish people would undergo slavery. But God did not decree which people would be the enslavers. And that is where free will comes in, because the Rambam says every single Egyptian, just like every single Nazi, could have said, as some did say, although not that many, I will not participate in something evil. Which means God may have decreed certain persecutions on Am Yisrael, but God never makes the persecutors do it. Now, again, God hardening Paro's heart is the next question, and that is going to be a question. But at least in terms of what Hashem said to Avram, Hashem did not decree that the Egyptians enslave, and Hashem did not decree any individual Egyptian enslaves. Each individual has free will. So you could say, for example, that the Holocaust was God's decree, again for reasons we don't fully understand, but that doesn't let the Germans off the hook, or the Poles, or the Ukrainians, or the Hungarians, because each and every one of them had free will not to engage in individual atrocities. Now, this is what the Rambam says. The Ravid, like you know when you learn the Rambam, you have the Rambam, and then you have Rav Avram ben David, who was a contemporary, we call him the Ravid, Rav Avram ben David, or the Ravid in yeshiva speak. And the Ravid has comments, sometimes very acerbic comments, throughout the Rambam. The Ravid was a great critic, that was one of his genres. He wrote criticisms of the Rif, he wrote criticisms of the Rambam, right? The Ravid liked to point out. And the Ravid does have a kasha on the Rambam, which is really another kasha. And he says, well, wait a second. You're telling me that the Egyptians are responsible because they had free will, because God didn't tell them to do the enslaving. That's fine. But if God decreed that there be an enslavement, where is the moral condemnation in carrying out God's decree? In other words, the Rambam is addressing where is the free will. And the Rambam's answer is, well, God didn't make you do anything. Therefore, you have free will. But the Ravid asks it from a different perspective. Okay, the Egyptian has free will. But if the Egyptian exercises his will in the direction of carrying out God's decree, why should the Egyptian be morally at fault? And that's already a different question, though. That's not a free will question. That's a question of morality and accountability. And on that already, the Ramban says, well, yeah, but the Egyptians weren't doing it to serve God. They were doing it for their own... In fact, they may not even have known what God decreed. They were doing it out of their own selfishness and evil. Yeah.
If the Chumash had been different, let's say, and the Brisbane Assembly happened, and every Egyptian had said on his own, I don't want to persecute these people, and the Chumash looked very differently, obviously.
Yes.
So then how would we read the Brisbane of his arm? Oh, we narrowly avoided this? Or
No, there would be another nation. So what would happen is that Ethiopia would invade Egypt, and they would then enslave. In other words, we would have been enslaved no matter what, but it didn't have to be Egyptians. And that's why it's deliberately ambiguous. Okay. Now, then the Rambam asks a fourth question. Okay, it's like the Pesach Seder. The Rambam has four questions. Okay, I want you to realize this in a structured way. Question number one is, why is free will not a contradiction to God's power? Answer, because it's a self-imposed limitation. Number two, why is free will not a contradiction to God's knowledge of the future? Answer, because God does not know the future. God experiences the future as a present reality, and therefore is not affecting our choice by our knowledge. Question number three, how could the Egyptians be punished if God decreed that the Jewish people have to be slaves? Answer, because God did not decree that the Egyptians enslaved them, and each individual Egyptian had absolute free will. Every single Egyptian could have said, I'm not going to do it. Yeah?
What do you mean by God experiencing the future through a present reality?
Well, that was... were you here the last class? Okay, it's okay. Okay, I don't want to go over the last year, but we talked about it much longer in the last year. But the basic idea is that the question that if I know what you're going to do tomorrow, you don't have any choice tomorrow because I already know it. I already know it. Is only a problem if you assume that the past took place before the future. So then it's already known. So when the future comes, you don't have choice. But since God is above time, so when God looks at the future, he is not looking at something that hasn't happened yet. He is looking at something as a present reality. Now, if I see you davening right now, I'm not affecting your choice. I just know what it is you're doing now. But you have choice. God's knowledge of the future is similar to our knowledge of the present. And just as my knowledge of the present is not impacting on your choice, God's knowledge of the future is not impacting on choice, because God sees the future as if it is present. God is above time, and therefore everything that is happening is, I mean, in a way, talking about the present is also a time vocabulary, so it's not even accurate, but God is seeing it as the present moment. And therefore, the question, how can I have choice if God already knows, is a semantic mistake. God does not already know. God sees the future as if it is happening right now in the present. Now, the fourth question that the Rambam raises is God hardening Paro's heart. Because here, his answer to the third question is not a good answer. His answer to the third question was, God was not forcing any Egyptians to do bad things. That's his answer to the Avraham question. But when you come to God hardening Paro's heart, you don't have that answer. Because there, God seems to be taking an individual person who on his own would have been willing at some point at least to let the Jewish people go. But God says, I'm going to overpower your will, as if you want to say yes, but it doesn't come out and you say no. And you're going to be punished and beaten and subjugated and more makos and more makos and more makos, so that the world should know that God is the ultimate master of the universe. Now there, you understand, this is question number four. And it's important to know, question number four is not answered by question number three. Question number three was the generic, the Jews will be slaves, and it didn't say who. So on that, everybody had their choice. But question number four is a direct intervention into Paro's free will. So how could Paro be punished for God hardening his heart? Right, that's question number four. And that's really the most difficult question, because that is a direct intervention into the dynamics of free will. Yeah.
See, there are examples, I think, where people are punished for things that they couldn't help or things they didn't really choose to do. So how can we have to say this is any different?
Well, any example you have is going to be a question.
Like, I think, like when Jacob took the birthright, and he was essentially punished for that, and just things like that. People are punished for things that couldn't have played out any other way.
Well, what do you mean? There was choice. I mean, there was choice. Nobody forced Jacob to do things a certain way. He made a spiritual calculation that he needed to do it, but that's not the same thing as overriding free will. There was a free will there. Pyro was unusual because God hardened. Now, let me just mention that the Maral of Prague says an interesting thing. The Maral of Prague says that God hardening Paro's heart did not take away his free will. It gave him the free will. What do we mean by that? Paro on his own didn't want to release the Jewish people. But what happened was, all of the plagues would break a person's will, like torture. Right? Under torture, people crack. So, God didn't want to give Paro the out of giving way after one plague. So God made Paro resistant to pressure, so that what would emerge was the decision he really wanted. It's a very interesting twist. Hardening Paro's heart was not an override of his decision-making process. It was to facilitate his own desire by removing the external coercion of an outside force. Which means, normally, it's part of God's rachamim that when we make bad choices, some bad things happen to us to push us in the right direction. But that's artificial. That's pushing us in the right direction, even though on my own I wouldn't go there. God didn't want to show Paro the mercy of artificially pushing him in the right direction by one plague, let's say. And God basically said to Paro, you're on your own. You have to decide on your own that this is a good thing to do. I'm going to make you, he's quite a guy really, I'm going to make you resistant to external pressure. So the Maharal says, quite amazingly, God hardening Paro's, if anything, Paro may have had the greatest free will in history, because he was a man that God made totally resistant to external pressures, as if to say to Paro, you are free to make the decision that you want to make. And even though Paro saw the hand of God over and over and over again, God made him resistant to the punitive part of it. But he still saw the revelation of God, and Paro still said, I don't care. He deserves to be punished, you see. That's the Maharal's interesting point. Which means, the gift of God is that we do bend with pressures. That's how pressures like Golus bring us back to him. Paro was not given that gift. Now that is what the Maharal of Prague says. That is not what the Rambam says. The Rambam gives himself another answer. Yeah.
Seems like just according to the Maharal, not according to the Maharal. But that Maharal is like this Sforno, right? Is that this bit?
I don't remember, but this part, okay.
It seems like the answer to the first question is, could answer the fourth question. It's a self-imposed, Bechir is a self-imposed thing that Hashem puts on himself. And so he just let it down for Paro.
Well, okay, so that essentially that's what the Rambam says with some elaboration. Because the question still becomes why, meaning to say, remember, that of course Bechir is self-imposed, but the notion is that the Rambam argues that part of why it's self-imposed is justice and morality. It is not fair to punish a person for things he had no choice. So you still have to answer, yeah, of course God can take away Bechir. That's not even a question. But where is the justice in God punishing Paro? So here's what the Rambam himself says. So the Maharal says that God is punishing Paro because Paro has free will. And that's why God can keep on punishing him, because he has free will. That's the Maharal. Very, very striking. The Rambam says the following idea. The Rambam says, we know that every sin that a person commits, there is punishment. And punishments can take many, many forms. There is punishment in Olam Haba and Gehenna. Sometimes there is punishment in this world, sometimes, not always. And the punishment in this world can have many, many forms. God forbid, there could be death. There could be illness. There could be loss of limb or loss of function. All of these are types of punishments. And they are punishments for sins that a person commits. Right? So the Rambam's chiddush is the following. The same way that a punishment for sin might involve a loss of limb, a loss of vision, a loss of a tooth, which might be a smaller problem, so too, one of the punishments that God can bring on a rasha is the loss of the capacity of free will. Free will is a faculty, sight, hearing, our faculties. Punishment for sin can take away those faculties. It is yitachen that punishment for pre-existing sin can take away the capacity of free will. Now the Rambam points out the phrase, and check it out, the phrase that God hardened Pharaoh's heart does not appear in the first five plagues. In the first five plagues, all it says is, and Pharaoh hardened his heart. Five times, God did miracles, supernatural miracles. The blood and the frogs and the lice and the wild animals and the pestilence. And Pharaoh didn't give in. He rebelled against God over and over and over and over again. At some point, God decrees to Pharaoh, or on Pharaoh, that you're losing your capacity of free will so you can be punished over and over and over again. So the Rambam says, you can't ask the Kasha, how is it fair to punish Pharaoh if he didn't have free will? If the reason he didn't have free will was in itself a punishment for his repeated rebellions against God. Let me give you an example that might illustrate this. You know, we all know that it's anti-halacha too, but it's a very serious violation of traffic safety to drive while you're intoxicated or even under the influence of drugs. Now, let's say, God forbid, somebody is really, really stoned. They don't know what they're doing. And they drive a car and they kill somebody, Rahmanul Islam. Now, they go in front of a judge and they say, Judge, you can't punish me. I didn't know what I was doing. I was drunk. I was stoned. I was on cocaine. I didn't know what I was doing. I didn't have free will at that time. How can I be responsible for what I did when I was insane? I was crazy. Right? You don't punish a person when they committed an act over which they had no control. I had no control when I was driving the car. But the answer is, it is true. You had no control when you were driving the car. But the reason you had no control was because of the decisions you made when you had control. To drink or not to drink. To go on the drugs or not go on the drugs. So even if those sins put you in a situation where you had no control, you are accountable and punishable because you put yourself in that situation. So what the Rambam is saying is, Paro indeed had no control, but it was a consequence of his intentional rebellion against God, in which he lost the power of free will. You might put it another, you might literally call it addiction to sin. I mean, you can even understand this in different levels. There is a point at which a person becomes addicted to bad. Now, an addiction, in a sense, is beyond your control at some level, although not totally. But you're responsible for putting yourself in that condition. You can't go back to God and say, hey, God, I'm addicted. It's not my fault. Didn't have to become addicted. Now, the truth of the matter is, with all of this, it is still possible that Paro could have done tshuva, and indeed there is a medrash that says, at the splitting of the Red Sea, he did tshuva. But it does mean that God certainly made a very big impediment on him, that he had to have extremely great difficulty. Normally, Hashem makes it easier for us to do tshuva. Paro was given a very uphill climb. Okay, so these are the four questions of free will that the Rambam discusses.
The first parsha Shmos, Hashem mentions to Moshe that he is going to harden his heart. So
yeah,
how is that not contradicting this idea of either telling the future or contradicting his free will.
So the way you have to look at it is that once again, he's telling Moshe how the story will unfold, and we have to understand that "I will harden Pharaoh's heart" is referring to him effectively telling Moshe, because Pharaoh will volitionally rebel against me over and over and over again, I will eventually harden his heart as the punishment I will bring upon him. Meaning the Rambam understands it. It's not that God hardens Pharaoh's heart from the get-go, but rather God is basically saying, because Pharaoh will behave a certain way, this will be the consequence. And once again, that doesn't override free will, because that's the Rambam's second point, that God sees the future behavior of Pharaoh as a present reality. So all of that is going to fit in. Yeah.
I'm curious, concerning the mashal you gave, it would seem that in the case of someone who is responsible for being drunk and no
yes.
longer having free will in that case,
right.
this was a foreseeable consequence of the actions they undertook while
yes.
responsibly free. Whereas Pharaoh, it seems difficult to say that he was able to foreseeably understand that his freedom would be divinely removed if he were to continue sinning.
Well, I think that maybe this is actually the answer, that a person needs to know, generally, it's not just Pharaoh, that the nature of sin and the nature of Yetzer Hara and the nature of going down a path of destruction is that it gets progressively harder and harder and harder to disentangle and to disengage. That indeed is a universal. That's correct. That at some point you literally cannot move. You're stuck where you are. And I think that indeed is a universal lesson. It's not limited to Pharaoh, as it were. I mean, this is why dictators, Hitler, like, I mean, they will do totally irrational things at some point, because they're so addicted to the situation that they're in. And of course, to a much lesser degree, Baruch Hashem, we are not Pyros, we are not Hitlers, but the point of the matter is, this is a lesson to all of us, that, you know, people often think they can engage and disengage with Averos. Oh, I'll do an Avero today, but you know, tomorrow will be great. You're gonna find, you know, you kind of get stuck in a certain place.
Why then say
and it's harder
God,
to move.
Why then say that God hardened Pharaoh's heart and not continue saying that Pharaoh in fact hardened his own heart?
Yeah. So the concept action. Would be, the idea of God hardening Pharaoh's heart means that even when you really would like to change, you find yourself not able to. It's as if God is holding you back, as it were. Okay, so these are some general issues about the notion of free will that we need to look at. But again, as I say, just to remind you of a point I made earlier, the overall 10 makos, the Chidushi Harim says, the first Ger Rebbe says, they correspond to the 10 statements by which God created the world. If you remember, the 10 statements of God creating the world are progressive concealments of His light. Creation is based on simtsum, contraction, concealment. That is why physicality exists. Physicality exists only because the divine light is hidden. The makos is progressive revelations of God's light. So it's as if creation involves curtain after curtain, veil after veil after veil. The makos are removing the veils to see the divine light. And that is why, in a sense, this is almost a reversal of creation, in which everything that is concealed becomes revealed. Now, do you remember a passage in the Haggadah that you read towards the end of the Haggadah, where there's an argument among the Tanoim, how many makos did God bring in Egypt? Because remember, the makos in Egypt are called the finger of God. Remember this drash? And the Red Sea is called the hand of God. So whatever God brought in Egypt was five times worse on the Red Sea. So the first opinion says 10 plagues in Egypt, and that's called finger. So Red Sea got to be 50 plagues. Although we really don't have a list of the 50 plagues. Okay, that sounds okay. But Rav Yossi Aglili says, well, each plague had four subcomponents. So that would make a total of 40 in Egypt, making 200 in the Red Sea. And then another opinion said each plague in Egypt had 5 components, so that would make 50 in Egypt, making 250 in the Red Sea. In other words, the ratio is the same. Whatever was in Egypt is 5 times worse in the Red Sea because of finger versus hand, and there's simply a machlokas. Do we look at subcomponents? Again, unfortunately, it's not clearly identified. What are these subcomponents? But okay, I mean they're very generic words: anger, fury. You know, but we don't really know exactly what form it took. Now, let me tell you, there's a vort from the Vilna Gaon. Yeah.
Where did we learn how to do subcomponents?
Yes, because it says in Tehillim. In Tehillim, Psalm 107, it goes over, it reviews the Yetzias Mitzrayim, so it says, Yishalach Bam, God sent against the angels Charon Apo, his fury, Evra Zam, anger, and also fury, Mishlachas Malachai Ra'im, and a delegation of evil angels. So there are 5 expressions, Charon Apo, Evra Zam, and Mishlachas Malachai Ra'im. The one that says 4 says Charon Apo is a general description followed by 4 specifics. Okay, so it's a pasuk in Tehillim Kufsayin, and if you look in the Haggadah will quote the pasuk. So there's a vort from the Vilna Gaon. Why are we so interested in increasing the makos? Like, what's the point? So he says, because Hashem gave us a promise. Every plague I brought upon the Egyptians, I will not bring upon you. So the more we put on them, the less can happen to us. This is what the Vilna Gaon says. But what is the significance of the idea that each plague had 4 or 5? So Rav Adi Yosef says the following. We know that Hashem's name of mercy, Yudke Vavke, is a 4-letter name of God. Yudke Vavke, that's the one we don't pronounce. We know that God's attribute of justice and punishment is a 5-letter name of God, that is Elohim. So the machlokas is this. Do we conceptualize the makos as a vehicle to punish and destroy the Egyptians for their evil, which is how the Rambam seems to look at it? Or do we look at it as a revelation of God's love for the Jewish people, that he's willing to do miracles to redeem them? So the Mandi Amar that says each Makkah has 4 components looks at the Makos keneged the Shem Havaya of Yudke Vavke, looking at the Makos as an expression of God's mercy and love for Am Yisrael. The one that looks at the Makos as 5 components is keneged the 5 letters of Elohim, looking at the Makos as retribution and punishment for those who are evil. So therefore the number of subcomponents in the plagues corresponds to whether the makos come from the Midah of Din or the Midah of Rachamim. Now I will raise a simple question on this. If you look at the Chumash, you will see that overwhelmingly it is always the name Elohim that is used for the makos, precisely because they are punishment. So it's a little difficult to look at the makos as the Midah of Rachamim. The Makos in the Chumash itself seems to come from the Midah of Din. But that's something to think about. Okay, we'll see you tomorrow. Have a good day.